Life and the world is a scary, scary place. But I've always imagined that life is kind of like being in an airplane at 50,000 feet and they kick you out the door. You don't have a parachute. Now, for the next 7 minutes or so, you're having a good time. The wind's blowing by your hair, but all that time, the end is coming. And that's how life is. And how do you deal with that? If, and I saw this. And it took me a long time to understand it. I saw during the pandemic people who knew that what the government was telling them was wrong. They knew that the vaccines were dangerous, but they took them because they wanted to be able to go on vacation. We are so addicted. We are so taken over by our comforts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Freedom Feature. And I'm your host, Barry Bussey. With me today, I have yet in our third, this is our trio, and it'll be our last conversation that we've had in this segment with Ken Drysdale, who is the chair of the commissioners of NCI. The National Citizens Inquiry, a powerful organization that has really been a relief valve. And Ken, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me again. I've very much enjoyed our first two installments.
Yeah, right. Well, I tell you, this one is something that I haven't really delved into online a whole lot, but it's certainly something that has been plaguing, I should say, it's something I've been thinking about a lot. I was going to say plaguing me, but not really. It's not that it's plaguing me, but it's kind of like a an epiphany of sorts. As we look back over the last number of years, and we've gone through this experience with, as we've been talking about, the whole COVID-19. The COVID-19, I think, is just but a symptom of something that I think is much deeper that's going on in society. And that is that as Canadians and as Canada as a country, we've lost in many ways a deeper understanding of who we are as citizens of this country, but also who we are as human beings. And I reminded and of Justice Ayn Rand. And Ayn Rand is someone that has inspired us here at First Freedoms Foundation. We talk about our first freedoms being freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and the inviolability of the person. And it comes from a 1953 decision in which Justice Ayn Rand dealt with a law that was in the province of Quebec that was holding back the freedom of the Jehovah's Witnesses and their ability to have freedom of expression and so on in the province of Quebec at that time. And he made reference to freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and inviolability of the person being original freedoms. In other words, they weren't from the positive law, but they were actually original. They came because of humanity being humanity, this concept of it's outside of the government, outside of the positive law. It is because we're human. And it was something that was deeply understood at the time, and we've had it throughout the ages. The idea that we as human beings, we have the ability to speak our minds, to search for truth, to be religious individuals, religious communities, but also to recognize we are to respect other human beings because of a religious idea and concept of the imago Deo, the idea that they were made in the image of God. And what I am just throwing out there for our discussion, is it possible that we have lost the ability to understand these original freedoms and all that comes with that, the metaphysical, the philosophical, the religious, the social, and so on. And in this country, like right now, people are wondering about, wondering what life is about, what purpose there is. And I'm wondering if that is not some of the angst that we are facing in this country today.
It is, absolutely. Listen, life and the world is a scary, scary place. You know, I've always envisioned, rightly or wrongly, this isn't deeply philosophical, but I've always imagined that life is kind of like being in an airplane at 50,000 feet and they kick you out the door. You don't have a parachute. Now, for the next 7 minutes or so, you're having a good time. You know, the wind's blowing by your hair, but all that time, you know, the end is coming.
Yeah.
And that's how life is. And how do you deal with that? And I saw this, and it took me a long time to understand it. I saw during the pandemic, people who knew that what the government was telling them was wrong, they knew that the vaccines were dangerous, but they took them because they wanted to be able to go on vacation. Mm-hmm. We are so addicted. We are so taken over by our comforts. And if you don't believe in anything higher, and that's not necessarily God, you know, that might be country. You know, I was mentioning earlier to you that, you know, I just came back from 10 days in California and with my little, and I will tell you that I spent 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 hours every day with that little bundle, that little 4-week-old bundle in my arms. And she'd be looking up and she would stare at me. And how can you not believe in something greater than yourself if it was only just this child? If you don't have that, and you're of the mindset that the ground is coming and there's nothing you can do, there is almost nothing you will not do to enjoy that ride, no matter what the cost. Why should I go out and vote? Why should I stand up and protest? Why should I do these things? Why not? Shouldn't I just go on my vacation? And so when you say it's a philosophical discussion, this creeping nihilism that we've experienced in the Western world it's probably the scariest, most terrifying thing. And you know, we've been conditioned towards that, and I'm happy to say, and I'll tell you a little ditty about that, but I think we're breaking out of that, because I can tell you, and maybe you experienced it yourself, Barry, and maybe some of your audience did. Do you remember 30 years ago or 20 years ago when you'd be going to that neighborhood party, and just before you went in the door, your wife would say to you, or your husband would say to you, "No religion in politics."
Yeah.
it's the opposite now. Yeah. You know, when we're going to a party, my wife is going, "All right, are you ready to talk about this?" So inadvertently, I think what the government has done is they're starting to get people to understand there is good and there is evil. Mm. Is evil some guy with horns who's in a lake of fire? That's up to you to decide. But there is good and evil. And, you know, the Bible, I'm not toting the Bible here, but one of the things it says, there's a lot of wisdom in the Bible, whether you believe in God or not. It is a fundamental building block of our society. You know, and they talk about one of the greatest sins, things that they look down upon the most in the Bible, and I can't remember the verse, is cowardice. It's ranked right up there. You guys can look it up if you're prone to do that. But cowardice, apathy, you know, afraid to say what you believe in, afraid of standing up. I when we did the NCI, Barry, you can't believe the fear we ran into. You know, we had, on all levels. You know, we had we started in Truro, Nova Scotia. Beautiful town, by the way. I love Truro, Nova Scotia. But people say, why did you start in Truro? Why didn't you be in Halifax? Well, nobody.
Or I would say, being from Newfoundland, why didn't you start in St. John's?
Sure, and I love St. John's. I spent a lot of time there with that puffin in that place, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And but you know, the venues canceled on us. When we were in Toronto, the venue canceled on us. Toronto's the biggest city in Canada, probably more lawyers per capita than any other place in Canada. And all of the lawyers who volunteered canceled on us a few days beforehand. Wow. Saskatoon venue canceled. We, you know, I mentioned to you before that the commissioners were independent of the workings of the commission, and that assured that we were non-biased. But what I didn't know is the first day in Saskatoon when we were holding the hearings, you know, where the commissioners filed in. This is kind of like one of those stories about, you know, you see the duck floating on the water and it was very peaceful. But if you look under the water, its legs are kicking like crazy. So we commissioners filed in, you know, at the desk, and we sat down, and the proceedings were about to start. And what we didn't know was all of the witnesses that we had for that day had dropped out because of fear. So the people who were operating the commission were going mad, going to the alternates and getting there. Now, we as commissioners had no idea, and the first witness came in and it just went. But the point is that the fear of losing this or maybe that opportunity won't come, and that fear becomes overwhelming if you're not considering something more. Maybe it's that little four-week-old baby I had in my arms. Maybe it's God. Maybe it's country. Maybe it's wanting to leave something more than yourself. Mm. And again, I think the government miscalculated this. I think the Canadian government underestimated the resilience of the Canadian people. And I think they've shocked them into rediscovering what life is really all about. And it's not about that vacation in Hawaii. It's not about that new car. I mean, that's nice. We all like to have a new car, but it's about something more than yourself, building something that lasts, building something you can hand off to your children. Somebody asked me, you know, why was I doing this? And at the time I said to him, and it's still true to this day, what would I do 30 years from now when my little granddaughter comes in and says to me, Grandpa, where were you? You know, and that's it, for my family anyway, that's been ingrained in me for generations. In World War I, my grandfather was in it from 1914 to 1918. My great grandfather, who was in his 50s, lied about his age. And he went until he was wounded in, I think it was 1916, 1917. My grandfather was wounded 3 times. My father, who was born in 1920, that was 20 years old when World War II broke out, could not go. He was what they called 4F. He had problems with his eyes and his vision wasn't good. And, you know, he carried that guilt for the rest of his life. You know, he refused, you know, he was at marriage age in 1940 when the war broke out at 20 years old, and he refused to date or to get married until his friends came home. So, you know, he got married at the ripe old age for those days of 30. And but that's commitment to something higher than yourself. Yeah. And if you don't believe in something higher than yourself, you're prone to this fear and this terror and this propaganda. I mean, what is your shield against it if you don't believe in anything higher?
No, and I think that's extremely powerful. And it certainly, we've seen it in the other generations before us, that they were willing to make the hard decisions because they were not afraid. And, you know, you mentioned the Bible earlier. There is a verse in the Bible where it says that God did not give us a spirit of fear, but of power, of love, and sound reason. Now, you think about that for a minute. Power, the ability to have that courage, to be brave, to stand up and say, hey, this is what I believe, this is where I stand, and I am not afraid of of anything that the world can throw at me, because I fully understand. I understand history. I understand my own family, you know, as you just shared, but, you know, that there is something higher when you held your grandchild. And by the way, I would like to let you know that my, my son, one of my sons, his wife just recently, as in 2 days ago, also had a baby boy. And so that's number eight for us grandchildren. And we're all excited with that. But they're down in the United States, but I'm looking forward to getting down there and seeing the little guy. You know, he is named after my great-grandfather, who was lost at sea in Newfoundland, went down on a ship, the SS Southern Cross. 174, 176 men were lost on that ship that had a load of seals that were on their way back to St. John's, but got caught up in the storm in March 31, 1914. And here, April 2, 2024, almost exactly to the day of 110 years later, we now have a grandchild who's named after my great-grandfather. And so that is as I look back at that, and I look at the sacrifices that the previous generations did, being willing to go out on the ice flows, and of course, never mind what the politics of the seal fishery is today, but nevertheless, the thing is that they were willing to sacrifice because they had home, in home, they had their young children and wife there that they were providing for. But the people recognized that, hey, you know what? I'm going to get out on the ice floe and I'm going to do the best I can so that my children will have something, you know, we'll have food on the table and we'll have all of the provisions we need. And yes, I will sacrifice my life itself to support my family because there is something higher than myself. And I think that today, part of this problem or the psychosis that we have, as you mentioned, nihilism, but also this narcissistic mindset, where we're only concerned about ourselves. I over the Easter weekend, just recently, we watched not only, you know, your traditional stories of Jesus and so forth, but we came across a video of Corrie Ten Boom, who sacrificed greatly in World War II as a Christian who was willing to stand up for the Jewish people. And literally, ultimately, her father and mother, a sister died in the concentration camps, and she herself was in the concentration camp. And you know, she was one who was willing to go to the very depths. And her sister said to her, "Corrie, there is no pit so deep where God is not deeper still." And the point is this, is that no matter what we face, there is something greater and higher for all of us to recognize, that no matter where we are in life, no matter what struggles we face, there is always something higher and more important than our own particular struggle. That if we are engaged in this struggle for the greater good, for the greater principles, it's okay. It's okay. Viktor Frankl, who wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning, who himself was in concentration camps, and he pointed out that, you know, the people who ultimately survived and were willing to take all of the suffering that came in the war were those who understood that they had a higher purpose, they had a meaning in life, and they wanted to continue. And he himself said that what really was important to him was that he had a wife, that both of them were taken into captivity together. Two Jewish young people had just been married, and they were taken in captivity in Austria and ultimately sent to the concentration camps. But every single day he was thinking of his wife, and his wife gave him meaning, And he would literally in his mind, when he was in the barracks, when he was out in the fields, when he was doing all of that, he could hear his voice, the voice of his wife speaking to him. And he longed for the day to be with her again. Now, of course, he had no idea that just shortly after arriving in the concentration camp, only a few days later, she herself was destroyed by the Nazis. But the point is that he had a sense of meaning, he had a sense of purpose, and it was that's what drove him. And I think that today is that people have, or a lot of young people today have lost that sense of purpose, that sense of meaning for the greater good, for the for a much higher virtue. And I again like the concept of the idea of virtues of justice, of truth, and so on, honesty, integrity, those kinds of things that we, that look, there's something greater than us. And I think as a society, we have lost that, and we were only concerned about ourselves. We're only concerned about our comforts. And that is a dead end at the end of the day, because you can have it all. You can have everything that this world can give you. But at the end of the day, if you don't have purpose, if you don't have meaning, then it's nothing. It's absolutely nothing. If you're no, if you don't have that meaning for your grandchild, for your child, for your sister, for your brother, then why?
Well, you're right. You know, comfort can be taken away. You know, you have a tummy ache, you stubbed your toe, you can't afford the new car, that's gone. But yeah, belief in something higher, whether that's God or family or country or wanting to leave some kind of a real legacy, that cannot be taken away. That is something you can lean on, you can hold on to, you can be inspired by it. And isn't it interesting that one of the things that they've been doing, whoever they are, have been destroying or trying to destroy all of those icons, all of those people that we looked up to? Were they real people and did they do something wrong every once in a while? Sure enough.
Yeah.
But if you all you do is tear down, mm-hmm. what does the next generation lean upon? What do they, are they inspired by? Certainly not the latest Marvel movie or Batman movie or something, you know, this ridiculous stuff. I was on an airplane for, I don't know, 8 hours yesterday. And, you know, I never turn the screens on, or if I do, I'm looking at the map. But you see these insane things that they're watching on. You know, millions and millions of dollars spent on insanity, which is so far away from reality. And these people are filling their heads up with this stuff. And, of course, they can't live up to this. You know, you can't. You can't get into a fight with 32 people and win, you know, but this is what they're being filled up with. There's no reality to it. And they're afraid of always losing. They can't get the new car. So I'm not happy. I've got a blemish on my cheek. I'm not happy. And that's a powerful force that's being used to destroy our society for whatever that reason is. I've been puzzling about what that reason is, and I haven't come to a conclusion on that, and perhaps I never will. But it just comes down to that: if there isn't something greater than your immediate satisfaction, then you're doomed to be controlled by outside forces because they can take it away from you.
Yeah, because your ultimate goal is just your personal comfort. And if the ultimate goal is just our personal comfort, then we will be pawns in somebody's power game that will destroy yourself, but will also destroy society as a whole. Yeah. We have to recognize that there has to be something greater. Viktor Frankl in his work often talked about individuals who had suffered a tragedy in life. And he mentioned one time about the young man who had his neck broken on a as a result of diving into a swimming pool and struck an object and ultimately was paralyzed from the neck down. And he said he was, that his neck was broken, but he himself was not broken and was doing everything in his power to encourage others. And what is fascinating is in Frankl's work, he points out that the people who have suffered the most are often the ones who will be the people who will enjoy life the most, even though they have suffered terribly. And I think part of what has motivated a lot of people, I think, over the last number of years, is that, yeah, okay, so I lost my house. I remember as I was going through Ottawa and I talked to this one trucker, and he told me his wife lost a job. He, of course, lost his job. They've lost their house. And so he was involved in the protest because of all of the loss. In other words, you know, you lose it all. It doesn't hold you back anymore, because now you've got to be something bigger than just trying to protect your house or protect your job or whatever. And I think there is a lesson in that. And as people, as we are now going to be suffering horrendously as a result of government mismanagement, from higher interest rates, we're going to end up seeing. I remember as a boy growing up in the 70s, where a lot of people lost their homes because of the high interest rates. And then remember late 70s, early 80s and so forth, you know, just ridiculous 20% interest rates and those kinds of things were horrendous. But I think the reality is that there's no guarantee in life. And, you know, you look at individuals who have been just recently given a diagnosis that, you know, they've got cancer and it may be terminal and all the rest. And those who just say, hey, all right, so I don't have much time left, so I'm going to do the best I can for my children, for my grandchildren, for my family, they make life meaningful because they have a purpose. Yeah. And I think it's extremely important for all of us to recognize that it's time. And I love I think that's going to be a theme of a meeting you've got coming up, isn't it? It is time.
Oh boy, that was a good segue. Yeah, you know, we often get wound up in talking about what has gone wrong, and people walk away confused and dazed and saddened, and they don't know what to do. And so what Barry's talking about is, you know, after the National Citizens Inquiry, we started something called Manitoba Stronger Together, and that has a plan that will work. And we're having a national convention, it's open to everyone, in Winnipeg on June 21st, 22nd, 23rd of this year. You can go to our website, that's www.manitobastrongertogether.ca, and look at the events page, and you can pre-register right now. You know, but it's so important. You know, what we're talking about is so important. It brings to mind two witnesses we had on the NCI in Winnipeg. One was a retired judge Giesbrecht. And I was questioning him at the end, and I take off my hat to Judge Giesbrecht for having the courage to come forward, you know, and testify to the things he did. But I questioned him about it, and I said, and he talked about the pressures that judges are under. And he was trying to explain, you know, how some of these decisions have been made. And I said, Judge Giesbrecht, just can I back you up a little bit? What pressure are they under? Well, you know, they're expected. I said, but they have essentially tenure. Unless they're caught doing something criminal, the government can't fire them because they ruled in a certain way. They might have embarrassment because it's gone to appeal. But, you know, that's the pressure you're talking about. And I said, isn't that interesting? I said, these people are paid whatever they're paid here. They're put in these high positions. They get all this respect. And what Judge Ginsburg didn't know is one or two witnesses before him, and I apologize, I'm terrible with names. There was a guy from, I believe it was from Steinbach, Manitoba, who owned a trucking firm, and he had 52 employees. And he testified that when the convoy was going down to Ottawa, he sat down with his wife, and they discussed whether or not he was going to go to Ottawa. And they discussed between the two of them that they might lose everything because the police were taking that kind of hand. They were sweeping in and doing, and so then what they did, his wife and him agreed that they just had to do it. They had to be involved. And then they went to their employees, their 52 employees, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but I don't know how many of those 52 employees in a trucking firm are driving Mercedes Benzes around like a lot of our judges are. And they all voted that they had to do something. So this trucker, this patriot, this courageous man who believed there was something more than his comfort, risked, at least in his mind, his family, his job, the lives or the prosperity of 52 employees and their families. And he went to Ottawa, where these judges are so afraid that they might lose some prestige because they can't lose their jobs. And I remember, I don't remember if it was Judge Giebert who, after we had that little discussion, he said to me, "Well, how many Mercedes-Benz license plates did you see parked along the along Wellington and his point was that they get so addicted to their comfort and their position and their status as opposed to what is right that we end up, as you said many times, we rely on those people who we never even gave a second thought to, the truckers, who ignited faith and patriotism, not just in Canada, but throughout the world. And you saw those protests starting all over the world, and they're going on to this day. And that was ignited from the truckers, not the judges.
No, absolutely. And now, mind you, I will say, I am a great advocate in the same sense that I think it was inappropriate for Justice Wagner to come out and to go against the truckers. I do think that our judges need to be very mindful that if they step out and get involved in the political debates and discussions of the day outside of the courtroom, I'm the old school that would say, hey, you know what? You ought not to do that. However, if you do that, then you must be willing to basically say, hey, you know what? I'm going to take off my robes and I'm going to hang them up because this is so important to me that I am willing to give up my status. I'm willing to give up my seat on the bench because I need to speak out.
Yeah.
And I know for myself, that's basically what was, I've seen it and I've experienced it myself. There have been times where I've had to say, hey, you know what? I'm just going to have to simply leave my position and speak out because I feel so convicted on it. And I think that's key. And so it's important as I walk the streets of Ottawa, I did not see any Mercedes, but what I did see were pickup trucks, and I saw tractors, and I saw, you know, the tractor trailers, like farm tractors and tractor trailers, where they were there full of mud, full of, you know, you could tell that they've come from afar, and they made their way up into posh Ottawa, where the bureaucrats live, where the politicians live, and there they made their protest. And it was powerful, and you're right, they've ignited Canada, and I think they've ignited all of us to recognize the importance that, you know what, there are times when we have to stand up, and we have to recognize that there is something much bigger than ourselves. And so it was the time then, and I think it's the time now, certainly as we move forward and we see what what is coming down the pike, we have to speak up.
You know, you're absolutely right, but I'm not going to let the judiciary off just that easily yet. Because you know what? Using things like judicial notice, which was never intended to be used the way it was during this. Judicial notice, for folks who don't know, is when there's an issue, but both parties agree to it. They can set it aside and say, we don't need to discuss that because we all agree to it. But what the
judiciary— We all agree, and the court recognizes it. It's not a dispute.
That's right. So, but what was happening is one side was saying, you know, this is wrong. And the judiciary was saying, no, we accept the government's position. So where is the rule of law there? And then the other thing that judges can, I believe, and I'm not a lawyer, but they should be controlling what's going on is lawfare. This is where the government has unending resources and they just keep doing all kinds of insane things just to bleed the complainants to death monetarily. And then that just goes away. Judges should be able to control that. And as a matter of fact, there are a number of recommendations in the NCI report that talk about if you're facing the government in court, you should be placed on an even field. And I mean, both financially and legally. So that if you've got a legitimate claim before the government, it shouldn't be on you to come up with these millions and millions of dollars and face this giant that has no end to the resources that they have, because they're just bleeding people. And the judiciary, you've got to stand up and take some responsibility for that.
You know what? You know,
there's an expression here to who, and I've just jotted it down, to whom much is given, much is expected.
Yes. Yes. No. And hey, listen, I'm with you on that. I think that's a very important point that we have got to pay attention to, and there's no question about it. We saw it as well with the government's, I would say, hiding behind the solicitor-client privilege argument during the Public Order Emergencies Commission, when they refused to release the legal Department of Justice or the Prime Minister's office, whoever the legal team was, that put together the legal argument that said, okay, well, you have reached the bar to be able to just go ahead and invoke the Emergencies Act. We have not yet seen that legal opinion. And I think that's atrocious. And I think that when whoever the next government is, they need to release that. And we need to see exactly what it was the government claimed that it had the legal authority to invoke what was ultimately found by the federal court as an unconstitutional invocation of the Emergencies Act. And I think that it's another example of how, and I've seen it in, listen, many billionaires and all the rest of it, or, you know, huge corporations will use this lawfare where they basically will say, hey, we are going to be bullies here and we are going to go along on the very edge of the law, if not crossing over so that it's illegal and we know it's illegal or we know it's very questionable, but we're going to do it because we got a policy that we want to implement. And then they will do it. And then it's up to the individuals or others in society to hold them account in a court of law. But they've already put forward their policy and they got what they wanted. And that's exactly what happened with the Emergencies Act. Yep. Whether it was, I am not convinced that the legal opinion was actually that convincing at the end of the day, but it was nevertheless a position that the government said, okay, well, we've done our due diligence by getting a legal opinion. But what often will happen is that sometimes lawyers may be seen as the legal guns, as it were, and they will do the bidding of their government or of their employer or of their client because they want to push the envelope. And that is not how we want to be. That's not how we expect government to be. We expect government to be well within the law and carry out public policy. Democracy is hard business. It takes a lot of negotiations, a lot of working around through all of the loopholes in the sense that you've got to follow the law, to be faithful to the law, even though that means you may not be able to implement your Emergencies Act because you haven't met the threshold. And in this case, we definitely saw where they did not meet the threshold, but yet they still invoked it. And so I fully agree with you that, and I fully agree that the courts have an obligation to ensure that parties are well within the rule of law, and where they're not, the courts need to be ensuring that there is this legal playing field and that the rule of law is going to be respected. Because as one of the great jurists of the United Kingdom said, that justice must be done, but it must be seen to be done, right? So it's not just, you don't just simply do justice, but it's got to be seen to be done. And that's extremely important. Yeah.
And I mean, the basic, you know, it's an interesting thing. This just occurred to me a couple of weeks ago. You know, I was going to the post office the other day. We live out in the country. And I looked in my rearview mirror, and there was a little red light coming after me. And they pulled me over, and RCMP officer told me I was going too fast, and he gave me a ticket. And within about 10 minutes, he had left and wished me a good day as he handed me a $500 fine. Now, I don't know I'm not a lawyer again, but in the hierarchy of law, I somehow think that the highest law of the land is the Constitution, not a speeding ticket. But when I sped on a country road where an RCMP officer was, I did wrong. I didn't argue with him. I paid the darn fine. But when the government violated the highest law in the land, where's the penalty? Where's the fine? Yeah. And so how is it that little people like me or yourself or whoever, some of your listeners, why is it that we get the penalty for the most minor infraction, but the highest law in the land, as a matter of fact, the law that starts out stating that it's granted to us by God, when they violate that, well, nothing happens. Nobody went to jail. Nobody got kicked out of office. Nobody got a $500 fine like I did for my speeding ticket. And Canadians are starting to notice those things.
Absolutely.
And they should, absolutely. And so this rot or this infection or this non-recognition of fundamentals is throughout that entire system. And it will lead to disaster, folks.
Absolutely. And that's why I think of it as a spiritual problem.
Yes.
In that we are, like, if we are willing to let it go, we're saying that, hey, you know what? It is of no concern, that it does not matter that a government has been so abusive with respect to the rule of law. And that to me is like, no, it's totally unacceptable. And it's something that as Canadians, we've got, you know, it is time. I love that. I love your program title. It is time for us to wake up and to recognize that this is unacceptable and we cannot continue. Why? Well, because there are things greater than my own personal comfort, folks. Absolutely. And that's why we've got to be willing to say unacceptable.
Yes.
Anyhow, there it is. Well, listen, I want to thank you so much, Ken. This has been a great marathon of discussion. You know, we've done three programs, a total, at least right now, over 2 hours. And it's been just wonderful. I look forward to meeting you in person someday. We'll have a great opportunity, hopefully, to have a chat and discuss about these things. We could go on for a long time.
Absolutely.
But thank you so much for the
join us at the conference. I think there's going to be some really interesting legal minds there. I believe Leighton Gray is going to be there, and a whole bunch of other people. There'll be discussion on law.
Excellent. So when will this be again?
June 21st, 22nd, and 23rd.
Okay. Excellent. Well, listen, thank you so very much for being with us. Give us your coordinates as to where people can find you again.
It's for the National Citizens Inquiry, it's www.nationalcitizensinquiry.ca. And for Manitoba Stronger Together, it's www.manitobastrongertogether.ca.
Excellent. Ken, thanks again. It's been a great honor.
It was a pleasure. It really was. I enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, folks, thank you for being with us and for engaging and being involved. I encourage you to look at the website. We'll have the coordinates there in our write-up on this program. But I also encourage you to not only support my book, 210 Degrees Celsius, encourage you to read it, because it's a great indictment against what we saw, or what I saw and what I understood to be the violations against our rights, but also what, in my view, was a trucker protest that I think we can be very proud of. Why? Well, because it was nonviolent. Why? Because these individuals, as Ken had mentioned, who were willing to say, hey, you know what? I'm going out of my comfort zone and I'm going to say enough is enough. Why? Because there are things that are more important than just me. And I think as Canadians, we need to recognize that it is time, that there is more to it than just my own particular comfort about my job, about all that I own, the money that I got in the bank or the money I don't have in the bank. The point is this, that life is extremely important. And when you hold that child, as Ken just recently held his grandchild, recognizing that, you know what, there is more to life. There is more. It gives us meaning. It gives us purpose. And our purpose right now is to ensure that this country does not keep sliding down the way it's been going, but that we all have a responsibility to recognize the important lessons of the past who have inspired us to make Canada the best possible place it could be. And it is time for all of us. And I encourage you to look at Ken's work and look at this program that he's advertised, and encourage you to make sure that you join us on First Freedoms. Go to our website, make sure you sign up for our newsletter. We have a weekly newsletter. And also, we encourage you to be a part of something greater than yourself today. And until next time, I'm Barry Bussey. I'm just a burger flipper, one speaker declared on a makeshift stage that was set up on Wellington Street in front of center block of Parliament Hill. I'm just a guy who owns a restaurant, who stood up for himself. And he went on about the use of social distancing by government during the pandemic. When you're socially distanced, you are separated from your friends and neighbors. You're isolated. You've made to feel alone. When you speak out and you're made to feel alone, it's scary because you wonder, am I crazy? Does anybody else feel this way? Am I all by myself over here in this little isolated bubble thinking something's wrong? My message to you today, he said, is if you're feeling like that, I'm sure none of you are here. But for those who are watching and aren't here, if that's how you're feeling, you're not alone.